This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Somehow it's 2025, and with that, you might be returning to paid work and starting to think about what that looks like. And that's exactly why we made the Ready or Not Go-To Guides. Tackling breastfeeding and returning to work, postpartum and return to work planning, and childcare 101, our guides are beautiful, easy to read, and filled to the brim with expert information. Take the guesswork out of returning to paid work and use the wisdom that we've learned from over 100 interviews with working mums. Get the guides now for $29 individually or $69 as a trio at readyornot.au. Julia Kiera is one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. If you listened to my interview with sisters Lucy and Emma Race, you'll know that I recently worked with the Outer Sanctum podcast crew. And alongside Lucy and Emma, I was lucky enough to witness Julia interrogate feminism and inclusion through the lens of pop culture and sport. When she's not working on the Outer Sanctum, she's the head of AFLW at the AFL Players Association. With a background in social work, what I quickly learned about Julia is that everything she does focuses on helping and giving voice to others, particularly those in the outer. She and her partner didn't really consider parenthood until a decade spent together. And when they would embark on their conception journey, which being a same-sex couple meant not making a baby the fun way, as Julia puts it, they wouldn't even know the half of what was ahead of them. At 14 months postpartum, a huge cancerous mass was found on the right side of Julia's pelvis. All of a sudden, she was faced with multiple hospital stays, a body that was quickly thrust into post-menopause, and the terrifying question of whether she would be there to watch her boy grow up. She would get through it, her partner would carry their next baby, and here we learn all about her experience being both the birthing and non-birthing mother, how self-preservation, a sense of anarchy, and the want for an unconventional life intersected with the idea of parenthood, and how she's navigated the highs and lows along the way. I'm Lucinda, this is Ready or Not, and here is one of my most moving conversations to date with the intelligent and insightful Julia Kiera. Julia, when we were emailing, you mentioned that it was about a decade of being with your partner before you really considered motherhood and becoming parents. I'm interested to know how you felt about motherhood and parenting before that.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I think because, you know, I've known that I was gay for a long time and was kind of wanting an unconventional life. You know, I didn't really think that my life would follow the same path as my sisters or people of my peer group or whatever. I thought it would be a different sort of, I don't know, Studio 54 adventure or something like that. The thing is, wherever you go, there you are. And I'm not that adventurous. I wasn't going to live in a, you know, studio flat in Prague and write poems, even though there was this part of me that thought I might. So I think that's what it was. It was getting through my 20s and realizing that I am who I am, and a different sort of a life was not what I wanted. I wanted to feel settled and have a home and a family and all that. But it didn't occur to me, I think, because, and I think it's also the times of, you know, I was born in the early 80s. It was in the mid 2000s that my partner and I were getting together, like having children. Certainly people in same-sex relationships were having children, but it wasn't particularly easy. It wasn't particularly common. I wouldn't have known any rainbow families around us. And although you know the science of it, the accessibility of that wasn't necessarily in front of us. So I think that was part of it too, was, you know, I was part of a footy club by that point, and there were people starting in same-sex relationships starting to have kids. So it was like, oh, this is doable. This could be us. So I think that was part of it too, was realizing that I am fairly boring. That in terms of what I wanted from my day-to-day life, it's not like I didn't want adventures, but in terms of the day-to-day, I wanted something really stable. And that sounds so unromantic, but I think you just get to a point where you realize who you are and what you want, and the glamour of things is not necessarily real or true. So I think it was timing. If my life had been 30 years earlier, it wouldn't have occurred to me that we could have kids.
Do you think that idea of you can't be what you can't see, and that maybe you didn't have many examples of same-sex parenting around you until all of a sudden you did, do you think with hindsight there could have been like a self-preservation element of that you knew it would be more of a project to conceive? So you thought because it is a more challenging path that some might face, is there an element, do you think, there that could have been preserving yourself of what might have been more challenging? So you thought, well, we won't do that because that's going to be harder and there's not many examples out there? Or am I putting...
No, that's quite an astute take. That was probably part of it. I think there's also always been a bit of anarchy in me in terms of, you know, that you find yourself outside the mainstream. And so there was a part of me that's like, well, we're just not going to follow the rules because your rules are so strict and we're just not going to follow them. So I think that was part of it too. And then suddenly you go, oh, okay, is that real? Is that just me being, you know, anti-authoritarian for no purpose? Yeah, so I think that was part of it too.
That's really interesting because I think even in my motherhood journey so far, there's been times where I feel like becoming a mum, and I'm sort of past it now, and maybe you had this experience where in the early days, the very act of becoming a mum felt anti-feminist in some sort of way. So I feel like that almost ties into it. It's this idea of, oh God, I'm just following the path that bloody every normal person does, and now I'm being boring and not interesting and all of that, which I think we start to unpack that that's not the only mode of motherhood and that's not the only mode of being a parent. I'm interested to go back now. You said that in your 20s you were an English teacher and that you had a period of feeling a little bit lost in what you wanted to do with your career. Can you take us back to that time and how you got from there to here?
Yeah, I've been on quite the journey with my career. When I was at high school, I thought I was going to be a psychologist, and it's funny that I've kind of found my way slightly near it but not quite. And then in the last minute, I changed my preferences and got into a course called Creative Arts, which was at the time the Victorian College of the Arts, which was a mostly a theory-based course in creative writing, visual arts, drama, and cinema. So I had a very classic, privileged critical theory, artsy kind of 3 years, but I would not take it back. But I realize now how that sounds. But I learned all about gender and social constructs through the arts. It was great. I wish I could go back and do it again and actually do all the readings and not sleep through some of the films. I think I took it for granted. But the result of that was, even though I felt really that it changed my brain and I met some amazing people at that time, that I didn't know what to do with it. So I'm from a family of migrants. It was very much drummed into me that I had to find a job. So I did a teaching degree and then started work as a teacher. But really, it was a short-term thing. I wanted a job I could travel with. So that was a way that I could do that. But it kind of fell apart after a few years because I wasn't very good at it. I found teenage boys really challenging.
Yeah.
I had grown up in a fairly sheltered world where I didn't have brothers, didn't have boyfriends, went to an all-girls school, and suddenly I was with like stinky 14-year-old boys talking back to me, and I just didn't know how to handle it. Like, I just didn't know what to do. Anyway, so went traveling, did a lot of traveling in my 20s and a lot of soul searching, a bit lost, didn't know where to take myself, and ended up back in Melbourne kind of thinking, oh, maybe I'll be a writer. I was okay at writing and tried that for a bit and got sick of myself, just didn't want to write because I was just too in my own head, too in my own thoughts, like didn't like that. So I just started volunteering at things, doing a bunch of different stuff, and it's through volunteering at the ASRC, the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, did a few other bits and pieces that I was like, oh, meeting social workers and going, okay, this could be something that I like doing. And so, yeah, so then I went and did my master's in social work, and that kind of set me on the path then to working community mental health for a number of years. That's kind of, and at the same time as my social work degree, I was finishing, I think I started it actually when I had started playing footy at the Darabin Falcons, discovered that women's football was a thing, and interestingly found that all the stuff I'd learned about gender and society 10 years ago at Melbourne Uni actually had real life application at a women's football club in 2010. Yes. It was really interesting. And yeah, and so worked in social work for a number of years, community social work, and then a bit of other stuff in the background and a bit of research stuff. And that's how I found myself eventually getting a text message from HR at the AFL Players Association saying, someone's recommended you for this job. Let's have a chat about it. So that's how I ended up applying and getting the role of head of AFLW at the AFL Players Association.
And was that role created for you? Were you the first to step into that role, or was someone in that before you?
It wasn't created for me, but it was I am the first person to hold the job.
Yes.
Yes, because it was the PA had done a piece of work around where their gaps were and found that they wanted someone who knew the world of women's football, knew the world of AFLW. Yeah, and that's, yes. So I've kind of, even though the job obviously has a position description, I've been able to mould it into something I thought was needed but also suited my skills.
So what does that role entail? What's a day in the life looking like for you?
Yeah, well, every day is different. The top line of the role is my job is to understand AFLW players and their needs and their lives in order to be their voice in the rooms where they're not. So often it's within the walls of the Players Association, or it's to the AFL or back to their clubs or other stakeholders, and to be able to synthesize what's going on for them, as well as in kind of a workplace condition sort of a way. And that takes a lot of communicating and relationship building. So visiting the clubs twice a year, getting around to a lot of players. Yeah, because it's a national competition. There are 18 clubs. There are players who are, you know, just turned 18, and then there are players who are 35. So being able to understand their broad needs is kind of the day-to-day of it. It's a lot of phone calls, a lot of texts, a lot of meetings, a lot of coffees to really get what's going on for them so that I can, and then trying to prioritise and strategise about where the gaps are and what we need to fix and how we go about fixing it in under the umbrella of we're not the governing body. We're not their club, which is their home, and we're not the AFL, which is their employer. We're something else. Yeah.
You seem to be quite full circle with your career then, because from what I understand, you love sport, you love sort of understanding humans and maybe gender politics and all of the things that come into that. Mm. And then you also love storytelling, yeah, which has led you to do a bit of media work too, I think first and foremost through the Outer Sanctum. Can you tell us about that podcast and how you came to be a part of it?
Yeah, I have real weird witchy moments sometimes when I think about my career, and sometimes I'll just be in a room at the front of a club visit going, wow, I'm really drawing on every part of my life in this moment. I'm drawing on, you know, social work, hard conversations. I'm drawing on gender. I'm drawing on this. I'm drawing on that just to, like, I don't know, make it happen. Yeah. So before the Outer Sanctum, I was invited onto a podcast called This AFL Life, which was a podcast in the early years of, or not in the early years, but started in like before AFLW started. And it was a week to week recapping the games type of pod, and did that for a couple of years. So, and at that time, there weren't many podcasts in AFLW. There wasn't much content. So we had a passionate, you know, listenership, including the gals from the Outer Sanctum. So they knew of me from there, and then I started listening to them. So that's kind of where that started, and they'd get me on a couple of times as guests. And then when they looked to actually branch out and invite four new people on, because up until that point it was the six of them, all Hawthorn supporters, all, you know, they're quite different, but all with a similar kind of take that they wanted to broaden out and get in some different kind of perspective. So I was one of the people that they reached out to in 2019. And then I think I started in 2020.
Wow.
So I had a few months in the studio and then not.
Yeah, it came pretty soon after that. So we'll get to how that all came to be and how you navigated that. Mm. You recently came back with my memory sucks given I was the producer on it. Was it six or eight parts? It was eight, wasn't it?
Eight. Yeah.
How was it to come back and do all of that with them again?
Oh, it was awesome. And, you know, a different format. I guess I took more of a lead with it in that, you know, I was a newbie, and it was very much, I felt like, you know, Emma's the team captain, Lucy's the first mate. I don't know. I'm going to mess up the metaphors and maybe upset the other members, but that's how I'd always interpreted it in terms of the week-to-week driving of the work. So, yeah, I kind of came to them with a different idea. That the pod had gone on hiatus for a bit. We'd left the ABC, we were doing it independently, and here I was at a different organisation going, I think we could make a partnership here and do some different sorts of episodes, because I think there was a general fatigue by the end of it around, and I hope that I'm not speaking out of school saying this, but that talking about men behaving badly every week and trying to find solutions for it was really, yeah, it had taken its toll because it felt like the outer sanctum was ahead of the culture and they needed to take a break and wait for the culture to catch up to them, which it has in some respects. But footy culture is 50 years behind anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
I feel like you were able to break down some very big concepts through the lens of sport. How has that influenced your life? Like, is that going back to your uni days where you did that 3-year course that really led to that sort of critical thinking? Because I feel like you explained things in those episodes in a way I'd never heard them.
Yeah, it does. That's the short answer. I think that I'm really grateful for having done that course. It was a very, like, we were a very privileged group of little kids in there learning about those concepts, but it taught me how to think critically about the world and to really understand that the world is constructed, gender is constructed, society is constructed. It's not just given to us. We've inherited it and we continue to live it. And so to think that sport sits outside it is just wrong. And that I think the other thing that, one of the many things, but one of the main things that I guess Lucy and Emma especially and I agree on is that art and sport are intrinsically linked and that the best sporting moments are the ones where there are great stories. And that's the same with art. So, and sometimes it is a ballet, it is a dance, it is a drama, it is heartbreak, it is all those things. That's why we like it, I think. And that because it's been the domain of men, perhaps we haven't wanted to say that it's artistic, but it is. And it still draws out the same emotional responses just from different sorts of people that don't actually say up the top, I'm here to feel something.
Yeah.
But they are.
Yes. So let's take it back to the motherhood piece now. After about a decade with your partner, it's clear that you want to be on the parenting journey. You don't have to go into any details you don't want to cover, but what happens next after you go, yep, let's do this thing?
Yeah. So I remember the chat. We were on holiday and visiting my partner's family in the country, and we were at this little cafe and we were at the back, and I was like, okay, what are we doing? And we kind of set ourselves a little roadmap around what we wanted to do. You know, we want to buy a house, we want to have kids, around how we're going to go about it. And yeah, so that was, I remember that conversation of, okay, is this what we want to do? But then there's the how, you know, we don't get to make babies in the fun way. We have to do it in the less fun way. And we don't have sperm. So we had conversations around how we wanted to do that. And I want to say this as respectfully as possible because I have lots of people in my life who have made families in all different sorts of ways and have solved the sperm problem in all different sorts of ways. But I think you have to find a solution that's right for you and that you feel comfortable with. And what we wanted, if we could achieve it, is that we wanted a known donor. We wanted someone that if our child had questions about where they came from, we had somewhere to point them. We didn't want a third parent, but we did want some kind of connection. So, you know, we made a short list and it was incredibly short. We had one person in mind and we took it to him and he said he wanted time to think about it. And we gave him a long time to think about it because we wanted everyone to be on the same page and to understand the realities of what it would mean for us and our dynamic as a trio and our future. And fortunately, he came back and he said yes. So, yeah, that's how that happened. I think that if he had said no, we would have gone the anonymous route.
Yeah,
because you need to find the right person. And the other thing is, and this has occurred to me probably in the last 5 years, is that you can make all these plans like, you know, I want my, you know, it was important to us that if our child had questions around where they would come from, that we could point them in a direction, and that, you know, we felt very strongly that our donor's relationship with us, we knew what the parameters were. You know, he's a fun uncle, he doesn't have responsibilities, he dips in and out in a casual way. But the reality is you create a child and they may have very different ideas about what they want from that relationship. So that's, and we haven't hit that yet, but we might. And I think that that's the thing that I talk about with my friends who are on this path of, okay, you have your plans and you have your agreements that adults have, but you're going to create a whole other person who may think completely in a contradictory way to what you intended. And you kind of have to be prepared for that and feel like your relationship with your donor is strong enough to withstand that. You're going to have a little independent thinker or two independent thinkers who have very different demands of what they want that relationship to look like.
That's a really interesting one. And you've maybe, because I am in an opposite sex couple, you've made me realize that perhaps opposite sex couples can enter this with more naivety is what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to think of my mores and lesses, because you've thought ahead to that baby that might be 10 or 15 and what they might think. Whereas I don't think I got past more than really thinking about the first few years of motherhood, but you're creating what will one day be an adult. Do you think there's a truth in that? Same-sex couples perhaps put more thought into the long game and the long-term, not ramifications, but the experience of raising a child?
I'd like to say yes, but I don't think we do. I think we're the same as everyone else in that we just dream of the baby.
Yeah.
And that's, I'm in my 40s now, and I've got lots of friends who are in their 30s just through life. And when they talk about their decision to maybe have children or not, I just keep reminding them, like, do you like babies or do you want a teenager? Like, this is because if you just need to smell a baby, there are babies around there that have baby smell. You can go and hold
babies
one.
Babies do smell good.
They
need to produce a perfume of that.
And you can go hold one and you could probably find lots of your friends who'd love for you to take that baby for a few hours. But do you want a toddler? Do you want a 5-year-old? Yes. Do you want a 10-year-old? Do you want a, you know, you're a parent for the rest of your life and your baby will stop being a baby. So, yeah, I don't know if we're more evolved than that, but it's something we had to think about that stuff earlier, you know. Yeah. What if he turns around one day and he was like, I want to go live with Uncle blah blah. You know, what is our response going to be to that? I think I know what our response is, but are we robust enough to be able to hear that when you've got a defiant 15-year-old who's really trying to push your buttons?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating one. I feel like from getting to know you that you're quite pragmatic and that you would have been really respectful that this person needs to sit with this decision for a while before saying yes. And in most ways you would have wanted them to, because this is also a big thing for you. You don't want them to be confused about their decision. What was it like waiting for that yes, to be like, yes, I will provide the sperm?
I don't remember it that well. I don't remember it being particularly anxiety inducing, because I think we felt like we had all the time in the world. You know, we're in our early 30s. We weren't like 41 or something. Just the old biological tick, tick, tick. I think we felt like we had time for him to turn around and say no, if he was going to turn around and say no. But I think I did know he was going to say yes, but he just needed time to wrap his head around it. But it would have meant something different in terms of what our family would have looked like going forward. Yeah, so I was pleased, and I think it's the best result we could have hoped for. But, yeah, it's tricky. You're asking a lot of someone.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. I would like to think that if someone came to me and needed an egg or something, that I could give one. But when push came to shove, it's obviously something that you need to really deeply consider. What happens next? So you become pregnant, and you mentioned to me that you did experience a loss before your son Toby came to be, but you said that it wasn't particularly traumatizing for you. What was that time like?
Yeah, I think just going through IVF, you get a bit, I wouldn't say that I was someone who particularly loved gynecological appointments beforehand, and I'm still not one, but you get desensitized to it. You get used to being poked and prodded a lot. And so I just felt like I leant into the science of it. And because I always knew that I would never be able to create a baby through sex, that it was always going to be medicalized, I wasn't grieving that. I think that's something that I think straight couples grieve. They don't get to make a baby in the magic way. So I wasn't feeling that. I was just feeling like this is a medical thing I had to go through. And yeah, I just, you know, with IVF, and I'm sure you've spoken to people about this before, but you know very fast like where you're at, you know, you're getting, you know, the first day you could possibly know if you're pregnant, you're having a blood test. And so I got my positive pregnancy test, and then you go 2 weeks later to have your first little scan when your baby's still like the size of a pinhead. And I think there was a heartbeat, but it was, you know, just not looking right. And so knew then. So I didn't have a lot of weeks of hoping and waiting, and definitely was upset, and then having to deal with that, ending that pregnancy and having a curette and all that. Like, they weren't pleasant things, but I didn't feel like I'd dreamed yet of that baby. Yeah, hadn't got attached to it yet.
Yeah.
And I think also just in terms of I'm generally a pessimistic person, and this might sound cold, but there was always a part of me, even when I was pregnant with Toby, that was like, I'm not going to believe it until he's here. So, you know, I'm 39 weeks pregnant and I'm like, I'm not going to believe it till he's here. There's always, there was, you know, you talk about the self-protection, like,
yeah,
there was always still that little
that element.
That element, yeah.
So then you do meet your baby boy. What's your earliest memories?
So I ended up having a Caesar, and I had, I think they're called riggers, where you just shake. So he'd been taken out and I could just not stop shaking.
Yes.
And so they're trying to put him on me, but I'm shaking and, yeah, just being overwhelmed with emotion. I couldn't believe it had actually happened. Because, yeah, it wasn't something that I was not a little girl who played with my baby dolls. I didn't. So, yeah, it's actually magical to think about. I'm so glad I have so many photos and whatever. And, yeah, then brought him out to the hallway. He got on my boob straight away.
Wow.
And then was up with him all night. And then I've been up with him all night. No, I haven't been up with
ever
him
since.
All night ever since. But, yeah, I think it was just a sense of wonder. Like, we've done this. We've created a whole new person. And but then very like in those early months, the kind of wave of dawning responsibility that, wow, I am not the center of my own life anymore, and I'm responsible for not only raising this child, keeping this thing alive. I was always like shocked at how small a baby is. Like you throw a blanket over a baby, it's like they're not even here.
Yes. And they can't even get that blanket off them when they're newborns.
I know, that's a terrible image.
No, but that's what we go through in those early days. It's scary.
It's scary. I'm like, this child can't do anything without me. It's tiny. Yeah. I am moving it from one room to another. It couldn't do it without me. Like I just was bamboozled by that sense of responsibility and also dread around that in that, yeah, and I had a lot of fear, which not to foreshadow, but kind of got paid off at some point, which I felt like I'd brought upon myself in some ways. But, yeah, a lot of fear that we had to look after this baby.
How did that show up for you? Was it that sort of nighttime dread of the night falling and going, oh, fuck, here's another night? Or was it anxiety around nap schedules or finding it hard to leave the house? How do you think that sort of manifested when you look back?
Not in those things. I think, you know, I have three older sisters who'd all had kids before me, and I felt very much like I had a lot of advice coming towards me, which was helpful in terms of sleep schedules and routines and how to manage it all. And, you know, my partner did half of it and all that stuff. And so I didn't feel at a loss and generally had a well-sleeping baby, or he had his things and his regressions and all that, but generally he was in a good spot. It was mostly internal, just worry about, yeah, and that changing identity of that I think lots of women in Australia in this time of life have, because we have children older and we've been independent, free-thinking people who can do whatever we like for more parts of our lives, and we've created identities and careers and whatever, and suddenly you are decentralized from that narrative and you are there caring for this little person and your needs and thoughts and whatever, not the priority. And it's a shock when you have to deal with that in your 30s. I think it's less of a shock if you had a baby when you were 21, like, you know, my mother's generation did, because you hadn't yet found that identity yet. So having it taken away, I think it would still be, it's obviously still challenging to have a child at any age and comes with certain things. But yeah, when you've already felt like I know who I am and I'm on this path and I've chosen to come off that path, even though I quite liked it.
What is wrong with me?
What is wrong with me?
That's a really interesting way to put it. I've interviewed, I reckon, 100 parents now, and I don't think anyone's put it like that. And especially in your case, thinking that you felt a little bit lost in your 20s with your career and took that time to find it, that makes so much sense. That, yeah, if you spend a bit longer in your career than previous generations, there is more to reckon with there, which is the perfect segue. Where were you at with work then, and what did parental leave look like, or what was the plan?
Yeah, so at the time I was working, I was like a caseworker in mental health. So I worked with people with a serious mental illness, with their basically helping them find meaning in life again. And that could take on all different sorts of work in terms of the day-to-day with the clients that I work with, and people that had, you know, all different sorts of mental illnesses, all different ages. And it was work I really enjoyed, but also, you know, has incredibly difficult moments, because you are talking about trauma and abuse and suicide a lot. So I was ready to have a break from it in terms of when I went on parental leave. And so my intention was to like string him along for the first 12 months and say, I'm coming back. And then say, actually, I want another year. And in that other year, I was going to get pregnant again. And I did go about doing that. And so when my son was, around the 12-month mark, started IVF again, had frozen embryos from the first round, had two implanted, or had one implanted, and the next one implanted the next month, and nothing was happening. And so I went off and had a bunch of tests, and everything came back okay, and then went again. And no, I didn't actually have that third one implanted. I was going to, and when you're going through IVF, they have to scan you to see like what the exact day of your cycle you're at, because they need to implant the embryo on a particular day. And so you have to go into your fertility specialist or wherever kind of daily. So you're looking at your ovaries. And the day I was due to go in, my doctor wasn't in there. So I had to go downstairs to a bigger ultrasound clinic. And so I was scanned on like a big machine, not just the little machine in her office. And that day I went in and she's looking at me and she's like, she just keeps looking back at me and she's like, you've got something huge in your pelvis. And I was like, okay, what is it? She's like, I don't know what it is. She's like, but it's not supposed to be there. So that was a terrible day. And then over the next few weeks, I had a bunch of MRIs and tests and biopsies to find that I had a giant, the technical term, myxoid liposarcoma in my pelvis. So basically a huge cancerous mass in the right side of my pelvis, which had probably been there for about 5 years. So that put a stop to baby making for me and put me on the cancer journey for that year. So yeah. And so when I say that the dread, like I did really that first year of parenting have this fear of mortality, like what if we die, what if I die, like who's going to raise this child? And then it felt like I'd manifested it in some way. Yeah. And so that was a tough year. Toby was probably 14 months when I was diagnosed. Yeah. I don't wish it upon anyone.
Wow. I know this part of your story, but I didn't know that that's how you found it.
Yeah.
Found the cancer. So was there basically no symptoms that showed up with that cancer? It's just, is it the type of cancer or?
So I'm actually very lucky to be alive, really. And it's kind of motherhood that saved my life, because the way it's been described to me, and if there are doctors listening to this, I'm like, that's not right. But anyway, this is how it's been described to me, is that the cancer I have is quite rare. They're called soft tissue cancers. And when they grow in a pelvis, in a woman's pelvis, they can actually grow to be quite huge, because there's so much space in a woman's pelvis for a baby to go through before they actually start showing up in other ways. So, and unfortunately I did get on Google quite quickly after I got my diagnosis, and all the studies are horrendous, because for most people it doesn't show up until it started to move into your lungs and so on. Whereas mine had been found because that part of my body was being scanned. So I know that I'm like a medical miracle, and surgeons love talking to me because I'm this unique little story where they get to do things which they don't otherwise get to do, because mine was found in the way it was found. So yeah, motherhood did save my life, even though it changed it. Yeah. So sarcomas can often grow, like can be quite visible. They grow on limbs and they kind of show up as a lump, whereas mine grew in a place where it wasn't going to show up until it had really started to push into other areas of my body.
Wow. Well, we don't have to obviously go anywhere you don't want to go, but I very much had that mortality sort of reckoning when my son came into the world. All of a sudden, my life mattered for the first time. Like I was worried about my parents dying before that, but I never thought about me. And then I realized that I was that parent, that I'd worried about dying in my own life. What did that time look like after that? He's 14 months. You hadn't returned to paid work. I imagine then you were just on a journey of fighting this thing.
I just realized you said that. I did go back and I started doing some I started working at a uni doing some part-time stuff, but it was stuff I could park. Yeah, it was pretty tough. So I started with radiation for 5 weeks, which I could kind of continue my normal life for. It wasn't until like 3 weeks into the radiation that I started to feel a bit off, but I could still, like I had told some of my closest people that I had cancer, but I had managed to not tell anyone else. I was coaching footy at the time. I didn't need to tell anyone really, but I do remember like towards the end of the radiation, I was there running a drill where I participated in the drill, I went and like demonstrated this tackle and got and was whatever. And I remember getting up and being like just feeling all the fatigue of, you know, the 5 weeks of radiation hitting me in that moment. I was like, okay. And then once I started chemo, that's when I had to kind of tell everyone that's what was happening. And the chemo that I underwent, like all chemo is horrendous, but I think the particular type I had to do was particularly difficult because I'd have to be admitted for 3 days where I was basically on a pump of the poison for 12 hours a day for those 3 days. Then I'd go home for 18 days and basically I'd come home like a shell, very tired, and then I'd have 18 days to recover to get my blood levels back to a point where I could do it again. So at that time, then my partner, once I started the chemo, my partner went on leave and went on carer's leave for 6 months. So yeah, so the radiation and the chemo ultimately killed the cancer, and then I had a big surgery to remove it, and then had lots of complications of the surgery, which affected my leg and my foot because the cancer was sitting on my spine and a lot of my nerves were damaged. So it was a big year. It transformed my life. It transformed kind of the way I think about the world, but also my physical body. I'm not capable of doing the things that I used to do. But it was, in terms of parenting, it was really hard. I spent the whole year just... He's so young, he's not going to remember me. But the lovely part of being in Australia is that I got free psychology through the hospital, where I got to talk about my fears with someone who wasn't connected to me. That was really difficult during that year because everyone was so frightened around me, and I just really, really needed to talk about death. But I knew I couldn't talk about it with the people who were really worried about me dying. And, yeah, it's maybe a more empathic human, I think, with other people. Just giving people space to talk about the hard things and not really needing to fix it. Yeah, but I had a lot of fear that year that he's just not going to remember me. And, you know, you have people in your life who lose parents young, and they talk to you about it and they talk about their fading memories. And I was like, I just don't want that to be me. Yeah. But
you're making me
you
emotional.
Don't get to choose that. Yeah.
Oh, that's
it's the fear.
So big. Yeah. Especially
yeah, it's so big.
I mean, it doesn't matter what age your child is, but I can imagine, particularly looking at a baby so young. You recover, or you get the, I'm not medical at all, but you get the sort of green light that you've recovered from this.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned, it changes your world so much in terms of the flow and effects of physicality and all of that, which I imagine is another layer for someone that's been a sports person, because that's part of your identity too. How do you then move forward through there? Something else I'm really interested in is that in motherhood, if we're struggling a bit, sometimes it's hard to tell the people that you love that you're struggling because you don't want them to be upset about your struggles. It's one of those human conditions where we all try and protect each other too much. You had this thing where you're a mum and all of a sudden this little being that you love, you want to stay around for. You want to protect the people around you who, as you mentioned, they're the ones worried about you dying. And you had to look after yourself. How do you get from sort of those really early days and that first year of really challenging times and sort of, I guess, reintegrate into the world and maybe return to paid work at some stage then?
Yeah, I think I was very good at compartmentalizing. So a few things happened. So once my just so all my treatments was through Peter MacCallum, and you know, I was in there a lot. I had a lot of admissions that year through the chemo, through the surgeries. I got an infection at some point. I had follow-up surgeries. I was in there a lot. But you get a lot of strength about just being around those nurses. They know what to say to you. They're not trying to fix it. They look after you. They deal with your big feelings. So that was helpful. I got free psychology through there. I had lots of really interesting like friendship dynamics happening that year where, you know, some of my best friends now are people that I knew and were in the same circle with them, but they just gravitated towards me during that time and just started showing up more and doing and just hanging out with me. And I think I took that as a sign of they can take it. And then there were other people who retreated, and I don't say this in a negative way, but there were people who have told me now, they were like, I just couldn't watch it. And I was like, you know what? I actually love that you just step back, because if you had come to me with those feelings, I would have had to look after you, and I didn't have the capacity. So yeah, so that having kind of some friends rise to it. And, you know, we've got lots of pictures of that time of like kids, people just coming over and like mowing our lawn or taking Toby to the park or just sitting with me. You know, we had a terrible day one year. It was the 2017 grand final, and the men's grand final, we'd invited people over to watch it. And because I couldn't go anywhere And so we just invited people over. And then during the day, I started to get a temperature. And when you're in the midst of chemo and you've got no immune system, you have to really monitor this stuff because you've got nothing to fight it off. And I think it was half time, my temperature hit 38 degrees. And I just look at Kate and I'm like, okay, we've got to go to emergency. But our son was there with this group of people that we'd invited over to our house. And we just had to turn around and say, can you just hold the fort? Okay, we'll be back at some point. And, you know, we just had people in our lives that dealt with it. Yeah. And then I didn't come home for 10 days or something because I had something wrong going on. Yeah. So there was all that. I think then because of the physical effects, I went into rehab through Royal Melbourne. And again, just being around rehab physios and being around those people that can handle your feelings because they've seen it all before and they have a nice way. They're not like polishing turds. Like they're not going to say it's going to be fine. Like I hated it when people would hug me and say it's going to be okay. I'm like, you don't know it's going to be okay. Yeah. Don't say that to me. But being around people that had that expertise, I found that really helpful. And yeah, it was like, it was, I know that my partner held a lot. She put up with a lot that year. We had some really hard times and really, you know, moments where we're looking at each other going, is tonight the last night? So that changes you and it changes the way you walk through the world and the way that you deal with every day. And yeah, I eventually got back into paid work just through my old work. One of my old bosses said she had this job sitting at a desk 3 days a week that was not necessarily in the world I was, the work I was doing before, but would be an ease back into the world around friendly faces. So that's what I started doing. And I'm grateful that I got to get back to work in that way and get out of my own head and contribute. And that kind of then put me on the road to over time feeling better and getting back into work I found more meaningful.
Yeah. So in a lot of cases, that return to paid work can feel, well, actually it can feel a range of things for people. It can be exciting for one person, a bit of dread might be felt by the next person. Did it give you like a renewed sense of self almost? Like, did that feel like a real turning point for you then after this really challenging time?
Yeah, because I was just sick of being alone, like or being at home. The work I was doing that first few years, like, was very admin-y. It was spreadsheets and stuff. It wasn't stimulating intellectually, but it was satisfying. Here's a list of things I need to do. I get to tick them off, and then I go home and I don't think about it again. Like, it was the right thing that I needed. It wasn't emotional. I don't think I could have been talking about suicide and mental illness and in a really deep way. I didn't have the reserves for it. Yeah, so it was what I needed at the time. And this is a thing that I think all sorts of people feel this, but I feel it particularly around, I like being around people who knew me before. It's important to me because I know I'm a different person now, but I like being around people who have memories of what I was like before or knew what I could do before. It feels like that's not lost. Yeah, so going back to an old work where people knew me beforehand, yeah, I find that helpful.
In what ways outwardly do you think that it has changed you? I understand that you say it's affected your worldview and it's maybe enriched your level of empathy and those sorts of things. But when you say you like being around people that knew you before, what does that mean to you outwardly?
Well, just on the like basic pride bit, like I was someone who was really good at sport and now I'm not. And so I like, there are some people in the world who remember that I was. And because I'm constantly reminded of it because I have a little boy who's very sporty and who's like constantly wanting me to do things with him where I'm like, buddy, if I could have kicked your butt, but I can't now. And it's so, and he's such a little boy about it, really grinds my gears. So being around people that remember that I could kick a footy all right, that's helpful. Yeah, I don't know. It just, I'm not sure through work what it is about that, but I think I wouldn't do that work again, but being around people that knew that I could do it and I was good at it, yeah, is nice.
How have you come to accept the way it's influenced things like being able to kick the footy with your son? I'm sure that's a process of like accepting that, and it would take some time because it's that new versus old identity piece. I'm thinking for anyone listening that has come across something similar, how have you learned to accept and move through that?
I think it's just accepting that grief is not a straight line. And I think it will hurt always, but you can't get stuck in the mud with it. Like, I think before this, like, I'm someone who would have said, like, I'm prone to dark thoughts and dark feelings and really mulling on things, but it kind of had to come to a crossroads. Like, well, you can do that and you can waste your life sitting like this, or you can move forward. And so there's a little Charlie Brown quote, which actually gets me, I still look at this and it gets me through days. And it's Charlie Brown sitting on the end of a dock with Snoopy. And Charlie Brown says, "Someday we will all die." And Snoopy says, "Yes, but on all the other days we will not."
Oh.
And that sentiment is what gets me through it.
Oh, I've got tears just very, very dangerously pricking my ears. They're about to come, but they're not quite there.
Yeah, that's seriously, like, that's stuck with me for 7 or 8 years, that sentiment. It's like you can choose to worry about the last day every day, but it's not today.
Yeah.
So
you can live the one you have.
You live the one you have.
That, I'm going to remember that now for at least 7 or 8 years. I'm going to keep that with me. That is beautiful. You're then also grappling with, as you said in your email to me, that means that you won't carry any more babies because that puts you into, I think, perimenopause. Tell us about that emotional journey.
Yeah. This happened so fast. So because of where my cancer was, I had radiation on my pelvis, but my ovaries were in the field of radiation. So I essentially got, within that 5 weeks, became postmenopausal. So my period stopped and that was it. I've got fried ovaries. And I had three frozen embryos. So it was put to me before the radiation, do you want to do like some preventative stuff and freeze more eggs and whatever? Because we had three or two, I can't remember. I just wanted to get started on the treatment and I didn't want to delay it. So we didn't do anything else there. But yeah, I think I had more worries than that. I felt like very lucky to even have one child. And, you know, you have a spare uterus sitting there as well in my partner. So I was like, okay, it's not the end of the world. But yeah, it's, you know, when you're also in the cut and thrust of IVF and suddenly it's like, oh, we're stopping this and we're doing this whole other thing. Like, that was a bit of a U-turn. But I don't think I've mourned it particularly. Like, it's not that I haven't mourned it. It didn't make me particularly sad that I couldn't have any more children. I feel very lucky that I got to have one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was more the menopause. Like, it started straight away that I just started getting hot flushes. A lot of the symptoms just came on really fast. I was a bit of a mess to look at because I'd lost all my hair and I through the chemo and I had these hot flashes constantly. And so I just couldn't wear it. At the beginning of when I lost my hair, I'd wear a hat. And then I just couldn't wear the hat anymore because it was like overheating me. And so sometimes I'd show up at things and I'd be like, I'm sorry, I know I look like death, literally. I can't wear a hat. Just deal with it. So I think there were moments where some people looked at me and like, oh, God, yes. And then I had to go into HRT, which I'm still on because of how early that this all happened. And, you know, you get high risks of certain things. So it was a few years of dabbling around HRT and trying to find the right dose that didn't make me feel crazy. And I definitely had, like, it was a terrible time in terms of trying to find the right dose and being having some really incredible Hulk angry moments where I was like feeling so full of rage or other huge feelings. And, you know, my partner would come up to me, and when it first started happening, I didn't know what was happening and it took me a while, but I got to a point where I just have to say, you need to leave me alone.
Yeah. Wow.
Because I'm literally Eric Banner, Incredible Hulk. Like, that's Eric Banner. Anyway, one of them, Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah. I think so.
I'm about to explode. Like, it was so awful. And it took, maybe 2.5 years to find the right dose where that wouldn't happen. But it's so funny. Like, I had my last period in whatever, May of 2017. Haven't had one since. How quickly you forget they even exist. It's amazing. Yes.
It's amazing that you went through that straight after that postpartum period, because obviously they're both very big hormonal changes that a person can go through. Were they similar at all, or was it like an intense version of postpartum, or do you not even liken the experiences?
No, it was so caught up with so many other like symptoms and side effects I was feeling through cancer, but the hot flashes and the emotional stuff. Like, I'm like, am I emotional because I've just had cancer and I've got foot drop and blah, blah, blah? Or is it, I've been put on this like estrogen and progesterone that's making me feel crazy too? Like, it was hard to unpick what's happening where. Yeah, but when I finally arrived at the right dose, it was like, oh, okay. Every 3 days, I don't feel like I could throw a car across the street. That's great.
What a relief. My God, yeah. That's not a nice feeling.
No.
You do eventually add to your family, though.
Yeah.
Bonnie enters the world, I think, about 6 years after Toby. Is that right?
Yeah, Toby, yeah, so she's about to turn 3, he's 9, so yes, yeah. So that was like another journey as well of, okay, do we want to have another baby and how do we do this? Yeah. You know, my partner's got a really intense job, full-on job, choosing to have a child in her job came with, there were choices, there were questions and choices that we kind of had to find our way with. So, yeah, eventually Bonnie arrived at the end of 2011 and 2021, and that, like, we didn't choose to do this way in that I had one that's my biological child. My partner had Bonnie, who's her biological child. But the day Bonnie was born, I loved that I got to watch it.
Yes.
It was just the best day. I wasn't the one on the table. I got to watch it. Yeah, it was magic, absolute magic. Yeah.
And what do you remember most about, I guess, that sort of first year of her life being the non-birthing mother? What was that like? And I know that you obviously had such a huge challenge that would manifest after Toby, but I'm really interested in the differences in those experiences, if there were many.
Yeah. I feel like I'm a psychic experiment because we've got to do this from both ends. And it's really, this is going to sound awful and Toby's going to listen to this one day and be like, what? But I feel like I'm a better parent with Bonnie. Because I'm older, I've done it once before, and she doesn't look like me.
There's no mirror being held up.
There's no mirror. There's no mirror. You know, my buttons aren't pushed in the same way because she's not a little childhood me that I'm working through the feelings with. And, yeah, I think before, you know, if you've got people out there who are going to make a family like ours, I think before we did this, I think I was worried that, you know, you wouldn't feel that connection or you wouldn't feel the parentiness with the child that you didn't have or wasn't biologically related to you. And I just don't feel that at all. Like, I was there when she was conceived. I was there when she was born. I was there that first night. Like, that's what makes the parent. I know she doesn't share my biology, but that's not the parent bit. And she likes me sometimes more than she likes my father.
That's so interesting. It's like separating what we've been told being a parent is, which is like sperm meets egg, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's actually like the act of parenting is actually parenting.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds so obvious, but when you say it like that.
The act of parenting is parenting, which is not to say that like biology isn't important and she won't have questions and all that, but the feeling of I am your parent, I know you, I have your memories, I can account for every single minute of every day of your whole life. I know where you were and what you were doing. Yeah. That's the parent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is going to come across, I'm asking a question that I think society has sort of led us to want to ask these sorts of questions, which I deeply do not feel is apparent, but I think it's there. And you can already tell that I'm nervous about the way I'm asking this. But what I want to know is, I feel like you're already answering no, and that's what I imagine it would be if I was in a same-sex relationship. Was there any point where you had to work through that you were more the boss, let's say, in inverted commas, of Toby as the birthing mother and that your partner was of Bonnie? Was there anything that you had to work through or dismantle yourselves in that sense because of what we've been brought up and being told in this patriarchal society of what parenting and being the mum is almost?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I'm not offended by it. I think it's something we've had to work through. Not really, but I think it's also just a general acceptance. Like, I breastfed Toby, Kate breastfed Bonnie. That's kind of how it is. But that both our children have distinct relationships. Like, sometimes Toby just prefers my partner. And that actually happened a lot in that first year. And the same with Bonnie. Like, I remember the first year Bonnie would fall asleep in my arms and not necessarily Kate. So, like, that your child gives you the signs that you're there too.
Yeah.
I think just generally in our dynamic, like, you know, when you're in a same-sex relationship, you get to redefine the gender roles and restructure it. But ultimately, like, the jobs still need doing.
Yeah.
So they still kind of get divided up. And if you look from the outside, you could go, that looks pretty straight. the way that house runs. That all these certain jobs are bundled up for one person and all these certain jobs are bundled up for the other. So, yeah, like you get to recreate it, but ultimately, like living a life in a capitalist society in the suburbs.
Unfortunately, that's what happens.
All the same stuff and someone's got to do it. So, yeah, like I am the more domestic mum sort of person. That was our plan, is that I would stay home for longer and so I would have the babies. And so that is kind of the root of how our house runs, but it's definitely changed over time, and it's changed a lot more since I've had the job that I have, where it's I don't have the time to do it in the way that I used to do it.
I do want to get to that, but before I do, I did have one more question, and I'm not even going to edit this out because I feel like we all have these moments and I want to normalize them, which is that I literally just forgot my question, but I really wanted to ask you it.
And now I'm trying to think
what it is.
Come on.
What is it? Let's think. Oh, I actually have remembered. Not to say that you had any sort of grievances going through the early postpartum and pregnancy and all of that, but I'm thinking I wish that my husband could go through that in that physical sense of carrying a pregnancy, giving birth, breastfeeding, all of that, because I think he tries his best to be a 50-50 parent. But as you say, we still live in a capitalist society. There's a gender pay gap here. It's more than me. Produce the milk, all of those things.
Yeah.
And I think with all of that, he can do anything he wants, but he still doesn't know what it's been to be the birthing person. Was there any validation or any aha moments when you'd both been through it?
I think there's a there's a validation that we've both, our bodies have both changed through this experience. We've both had to do it and our bodies have both changed. And as you're in your 40s and you're women and all that, like, it's like we both did this thing and it's not one of us and not the, you know, I'm not carrying all the scars and she's not. So I think that's there. I think it did just make it easier in those early weeks in that I understood what she was going through, starting to breastfeed and all that. And yeah, I got it on a cellular level, which is not to say that I wouldn't have understood it, but she might have had to speak it more for me to understand it.
That's really interesting. It's more the unspoken.
Yeah.
What is making work looking like today then? As you say, you have less time and more paid work responsibility. How has that made running a household and running a career and looking after kids, how has that changed?
Oh, it's changed dramatically in the last few years. As I alluded to, my partner's a really full-on job that's a lot of hours and a lot of nights, and I have the job I have that involves a lot of responsibility and a lot of travel. So we've had to get more help. You know, we have a nanny that we call on a lot. We've had grandparents who help us out with things. You know, we have a network of parents around that I'll sometimes be saying, can you just, you know, walked over to school today sort of thing. So we've just had to accept that we can't do it all. We're in a challenging time, I think, for us in terms of what we've chosen to take on, where we both love our jobs and we are both quite ambitious, but we have children in the age that they're at. And I think there'll be times, I hope, in the future, well, I think there will be a moment in a few years' time where we'll look back on these years that we've lived through and gone, that was a stupid amount of stuff to be doing. But you know, you don't get to pick and choose when these opportunities come to you. So, yeah, we're in hard years at the moment. Yeah. But I think that was always helpful to me when you had, you know, a little toddler by your side and you'd be somewhere and you'd be pulling out your head and an older woman or another mother would just walk past and will go, these are hard years.
As opposed to enjoy every moment.
Like, as just opposed to enjoy it, just these like are hard these years. Hard years. That's it. That's all.
Someone actually said that to me yesterday at the Christmas thing. They're like, you're in a busy period right now, aren't you? And I was like, yeah, we are. But I'm glad that because that explains a few of the moods I've had lately. My last question to Julia, and I genuinely think there is so many ways you could answer this, but if opposite sex couples could learn something from same sex couples, what do you think it would be?
Oh, goodness.
Because I just think there's such a deep understanding that you and your partner would have. And I'm not saying it's perfect, you know, you're just a couple like everyone else. But I do think that there would be so much that it would be amazing for people to learn.
Yeah, that's such a big question. I think that one of the great things, but also a burden, of being in a same-sex relationship is that you get to make it up. You get to make up what you want your dynamic to be. You get to make up how you want the roles to be divided and distinguished. You it's not handed down to you. It's not, this is how my parents did it and that's how I intuitively feel it's going to work, or these are the couples around each other. You get to make it up. As a result, it is a burden in that, like, you're making it up as you go along and sometimes you make missteps. But I think that creativity and openness that we have chosen to be together and therefore we can create the life that we want and not the life that we've handed to us is something that straight people can do too. And you can do it in a way where you feel like power is distributed in a way that you're comfortable with. And it, again, it doesn't mean that you have to rip it all up. Like, if your husband likes mowing the lawn and you don't, let him do it. Like, it doesn't mean that. But, yeah, that sense of creativity and freedom is, I think, a gift that gay people have, in that we get to create the lives that we want. We get to create the families that we want in a way where there are rules, but there aren't as many rules.
Yeah, that's a really great sentiment and piece of advice to end with. I don't think you're big socially online. I think you're on private. But where can people find your work, or maybe the Outer Sanctum, if they want to listen to more of you?
Yeah, just go, I am pretty on private.
And that's fine. I get it.
Yeah, go. I'd love people to listen to the most recent season of The Outer Sanctum. It was 8 episodes. It starts with the 7-year itch, ends in Cherish. I think they were 8 great episodes. I think they're relatively timeless. They're amazing. Yeah, if you're interested in how sport and art collide, how belonging in community is something that we all want, and you can find it through sport and through women's sport, do that. I think that the themes of the pod were great, and Lucy and Emma are just two of the smartest, most deeply thinking and feeling people you could listen to, and I was very happy to be chatting to them.
You are exactly like them, all three of you were incredible to listen to. I learned probably more in that few weeks than I did in my entire university education. So it was great to get to know you through that, and it's been amazing to chat with you today. Thank you for being here.
No worries. Thanks, Lou.
Thanks for listening to Ready or Not. If you liked the show, please tell your friends, subscribe, or write a review. You can also find us on Instagram at readyornot.pod. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.